I don't think the Obama administration did all it could for General Motors. I think it should have did more.
Hello and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. I'm Adam Davidson in New York.
And I'm David Kestenbaum in Washington, D.C. Today is Friday, May 29th. That was Daryl Roper, a GM employee you heard at the top. On the podcast today, we talk about the economic logic of a ruthless madman.
Yeah, that's in our Jim Cramer segment. We'll also be taking a look at the regime of Kim Jong-il.
But first, our Planet Money indicator is 5.7%.
Actually, negative 5.7%.
Right. Sorry, I forgot the minus sign. The U.S. economy shrank at an annualized rate of 5.7% in the first 3 months of the year. And that actually counts as good news.
Well, relatively, and only in a time like this. The Commerce Department originally reported that the economy shrank at a 6% rate in those 3 months. As they always do, they took some time and gave a more careful look and have adjusted the number a bit upwards.
So the economy shrank a lot, but not quite as much as we thought. There, don't you feel richer already?
So now we switch to another economy that's having a tough time, the North Korean economy. This is a topic I've been more and more fascinated by lately.
And you spoke with Curtis Melvin. He's an economics PhD student at George Mason University, and he's got this blog, North Korea Economy Watch.
We link to it on the Planet Money blog at npr.org/money. Melvin started thinking a lot, really becoming obsessed with the North Korean economy when he went to the country, actually twice as a tourist. I asked him, how do you go to North Korea?
I don't recommend you go the way I do, because I actually visited with a pro-North Korean communist group. And so I
was are you a pro-North Korean communist?
No, I'm not at all, just for the record. It was one of the only ways I could get in at the time. And I was subjected to significantly more propaganda than the usual tourist is.
Is this an American pro-North Korean?
No, it's actually, it was mostly Europeans.
And wow. How'd you find them?
The lovely power of the internet to bring people together.
Did you get to travel around? What did you get to see?
I've seen quite a bit of North Korea. I visited, obviously, Pyongyang for a few days. They take you around and show you the main monuments there. Everyone has to go to Mansu Hill, which is the where the largest, most popular statue of President Kim Il-sung exists. We also got to go to his mausoleum in Pyongyang, and he's held in state like Lenin and Chairman Mao and Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam.
Oh, you see his embalmed body.
That's exactly right. It's on a scale above. I've seen the others, and it's on a scale significantly higher than any of the other communist leaders that are being preserved.
You mean it's a massive palace?
Yeah, it's a shrine. It was his office. It was essentially the White House of North Korea. And when he died, they converted it into, without beating around the bush, it's a fairly ridiculously sized mausoleum covered in marble. They spent billions of dollars on it. You go through, you ride in on an escalator that's like a kilometer long. And you walk through a metal detector, and then you go through this air tunnel that blows all the dust off your clothes. And when you enter the room with Kim Il-sung's body, you sort of march in line and then bow on all three sides of it. And then when you go out the other end, you walk through several rooms where they have his Mercedes, his train car, and various honorary degrees and awards he's been given by, you know, leaders of third world countries and non-allied countries. It's all very funny, actually.
All right, this should probably come as a surprise to nobody, but Melvin says when you're a tourist, you see a very choreographed picture. But even that choreography reveals a lot about the place.
North Korea is stuck in a time warp, and you feel that from the minute you get on the airplane in Beijing to fly to Pyongyang. The music is reminiscent of the 1950s. The hairstyles of the waitresses on the airplane look straight out of Donna Reed, and so do their in-flight uniforms. And when you arrive in North Korea, they do not tell you about the recent changes that have happened there. They tell you the official account of the state of their economy, and there's very little data
Those recent changes he's talking about are the first flickers, and it's possible they're also the last flickers of free market activity there.
Hey, Adam, I have to say, you know, I picture North Korea as a classic Stalinist state, literally like a museum, you know, the last place you can go to see communism in action. I imagine a central government that sort of that tells every worker what job to do, every factory what to produce. But what, so what's he say? Is he saying there actually are privately owned stores and businesses there?
No, not exactly. I mean, your picture is pretty accurate. North Korea is a big Stalinist communist state. Everybody there has an assigned job and they have to go there every day or they get in a lot of trouble. They get paid a small wage. It's on average, Melvin says, the equivalent about $1 a month.
Wow. You can't live off $1 a month, can you? I mean, it's poor, but
not even in North Korea. You can't live off of that. Absolutely not. And, you know, it used to be the state would provide your basic necessities. They gave you a house, they gave you food. But, you know, since the Soviet Union fell, since the big famine in the 1990s, the government just can't give everybody food. So people started growing their own. They'd get a chicken and take the eggs and sell them to their neighbors, or they'd grab some rice and make noodles at home and sell those to their neighbors.
See, that doesn't sound very communist to me. Was that illegal? The government let them do it?
At first, it was illegal, or it was just completely under the surface. This was just people desperately trying to survive, and you know they'd make a few pennies here or there. But eventually, the government noticed this was happening, and instead of completely getting rid of it, they recognized that people do need this market mechanism to get food. So the government sort of accommodates this little small free market activity. It's kind of like what happened at different times in the Soviet Union and in China.
Right. But for that reason, it's going to look scary to the North Korean government, right? Because they look over at what happened in the Soviet Union and they see, you know, that if people start making money on their own, maybe they don't really need the big state government anymore. You know, there's this independent, messy, capitalist thing that the government has to deal with.
Right, and they have no power over it. Look what happened to the Soviet Union. You know, it collapsed, and the North Korean regime, above all else, does not want to collapse. So the markets work, but they carefully control them. And there's this other thing. They do not want people outside of North Korea knowing anything about these markets. The official North Korea story, and North Korea loves its official story, is that the state provides all needs to the people. So it's awfully embarrassing to have people know about these markets. And also, they're worried that Americans and other Westerners will look at these markets and say, wow, there's this independent power base. Maybe we can work with that to overthrow the regime. So Melvin was not able to go to any of these markets except the one big public one in Pyongyang. But he said when he got home to Virginia, he was actually able to learn a lot more about these markets than he did there because he uses Google Earth, the unbelievably cool program that allows you to zoom in, and it has really good satellite images of North Korea, and you can actually see these markets dotting the country. And he says, you know, you can even see how they have grown over the last few years. Also on our blog, we link to his very helpful Google Earth plugin that identifies the markets and many other things there, including the big estates of the rich elitist rulers and lots of other facts about North Korea. It's really, I've spent a lot of time on it. It's really, really cool. The other thing he said is go to YouTube, one of the most subversive tools in the anti-North Korea battle, because there are these anti-regime activists who, in most of them in China, who've been smuggling cameras into North Korea and encouraging North Koreans to record these markets so we can learn more about them. You can also find those by going to YouTube and just entering North Korea market in the search term. I did this while I was talking to Curtis Melvin.
Jangmadong is the North Korean word for market.
Oh. Yeah. So this is Free North Korea Broadcasting. And it looks like a camera in a bag.
Yeah.
A hole in a bag. But it's a more formal-looking market than I would have expected. It's you can see these little, I mean, it's not fancy, but it's little concrete stands with sort of tin roofs, it looks like.
Yeah.
And it's sort of busy. It's lots of people. It looks like clothes are the main thing.
Yeah, it's very, very normal goods. It's clothes, food, household appliances. There's nothing really great or nothing surprising about them. It's just that foreigners are not allowed to see them. And actually, there was I'm not sure if he's Chinese or American or Chinese-American. There's a student at Yale. His name is Jerry Guo. And he went with a Chinese tour group to North Korea last year, and he was staying in the Yonggakdo Hotel, which is a tourist hotel in the middle of the Taedong River. They keep all the tourists on an island. And since Jerry was Asian, he was able to walk right across the bridge and enter Pyongyang without anyone batting an eye at him. And there's a small market, it's just called the Central Market. It's the market that serves the Central District in Pyongyang. And he walked right in there, and no one stopped him. And he was able to get about four or five pictures of that market before someone saw him and blew a whistle. And he was surrounded and ushered off to this office and then interrogated by various levels of officials. And he hid the data card from his camera somewhere else on his body, and they never went through a great effort to get it back from him. But he got out with the photos of the inside of this market, and it was nothing spectacular except that there weren't any photos of this market available, and it was unremarkable in any sense except that we saw just how normal the market was.
So, Dave, these markets are radically changing the outsider's view of North Korea in a really complicated way. Basically, what Melvin told me and some other people who study North Korea's economy is that the farther you get away from Pyongyang, the more important these markets are. And they really are doing that thing the regime is scared of. They are creating independent local power bases. And it's not entirely clear where this is going. These are still small and nascent enough that the North Korean regime could crush them, we assume, pretty easily. But the North Korean regime so far is letting this flourish. And it's gotten to the point where some regional governors, some regional local officials away from Pyongyang are making so much money through corrupt bribes and the like off of these markets that they're encouraging them to exist even against the interests of the central state. So we don't know where this is going. We don't know what this will mean. But some people who want to see the regime of Kim Jong-il fall say that they see promising signs. Other people tell me there are no promising signs. The Kim Jong-il regime, even after his stroke, is here to stay. That even if he passes away, it will still be a tightly controlled Stalinist state.
That's so interesting. It really is like capitalism just sort of happens if you let it.
Well, people trade goods, you know, and want to get something for the goods they trade. It might not be a fully functioning capitalist system like ours, but it does seem to pop up when states can no longer provide for the basic necessities.
All right. The show today is actually, I'm realizing, a study in contrast, because now we're going to go from a country stuck in, I don't know, whatever decade. And when you say market there, you know, you really mean a stall with a metal roof selling used clothes or something. And we go from that to home here, America, with the internet, with the stock market, with cable TV, and with this guy, I'm just going to whisper his name, Jim Cramer.
It is time! It is time for the lightning round of Cramer's Spend Money! Oh boy, rapid fire calls, where's another? You said the name of the stock! I tell you whether to buy or sell, and just to be clear...
So, David, you told me that Jim Cramer, like you, went to Harvard?
Yeah, he's not very public radio, is he? I mean, he sort of reminds me of, I think of him as being like professional wrestling crossed with Pee Wee Herman crossed with investment advice or something like that.
Oh, okay. So that's standard Harvard.
So, should we say a little bit about his show?
Yeah, please, for people who somehow have missed his show. And frankly, I have only watched little snippets of it in hotels and stuff. I've not ever sat down and really watched it.
Right. Well, he tells people, he basically gives stock advice. People call up and say, what should I do with this? And he says, buy it, sell it. And
we should just say, it's on CNBC. It's called Mad Money.
Right. It's very, very, very popular, especially with the college crowd. And, you might have seen him getting beat up on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. You watched that, right?
Yeah, I saw Jon Stewart I believe he called Jim Cramer a snake oil salesman, a cheerleader for Wall Street. He said John Stewart was basically saying that Jim Cramer was in partnership with Wall Street to cheat the American people. Maybe I'm overstating it a little bit.
No, I think that's basically what he was saying. Yeah. So I was really interested because someone then sent me this study recently, which is actually going to be published in an actual academic journal, which analyzed Jim Cramer's stock picks. And it found, I'm sorry, John Stewart, Jim Cramer actually not totally mad. So we did this story on Morning Edition, and we're going to play it here. And then we're going to talk about something you and I, Adam, both know and love, and that I actually just got into a fight over at brunch over the weekend.
Right. I mean, we are geeks. I think that's safe to say. And we waste an awful lot of time, including our Sunday brunches sometimes, arguing about this really crucial topic, the efficient market hypothesis. What is the efficient market hypothesis? It basically gets at this question. Can anybody actually beat the stock market? But first, let's actually just hear your Jim Cramer story.
Hey, I'm Cramer. Welcome to Mad Money. Welcome to Cramerica.
On a typical show, Jim Cramer runs around on the set in a tie, sleeves rolled way up, taking calls from investors wanting advice. When he needs a sound effect, he pounds oversized buttons.
It's the perfect time to examine what could go wrong with this market.
Cramer has become a national figure, which got Paul Bolster and Emery Trahan interested. They're finance professors at Northeastern University. And let's be honest, they don't watch Mad Money very often.
I can't say that I'm a regular viewer.
Mostly at the gym on the Stairmaster.
Scores of people do watch Cramer, though, and follow his advice. So Bolster and Trahan decided to analyze Cramer's stock picks. Bolster, for his part, had his doubts Cramer would come out very well.
I thought that this guy really is, he's a spectacular entertainer. He attracts a lot of people. He gets a lot of interest and probably attracts a lot of naive investors along the way who'll pretty much do whatever he says.
In their study, Bolster and Trahan considered an imaginary investment account. When Cramer said buy,
pull the trigger, the fundamentals on Hanson are on fire.
They put that stock in the portfolio. When Cramer said sell,
no, sell that stock.
They took the stock out. Bolster and Trahan haven't finished analyzing the recent market crash, but over 2.5 years from mid-2005 to 2007, Bolster says Jim Cramer beat the major stock market benchmarks, including the Dow and the S&P 500.
His return, the annualized return over the period we looked at, was a little over 12% versus the S&P, which earned about 7.4% over the same time.
Wow, that's pretty substantial.
It is quite substantial.
12% compared to 7%. But that comes with an asterisk that makes the results a lot more ordinary. Cramer beat the stock market, but he did it by taking on more risk. It's what you might get by buying the stocks of smaller companies. On average, they grow faster, but there's a lot more up and down. Think about it this way. You can get somewhere faster by driving 100 miles an hour, but that comes with greater risk. Every once in a while, you'll hit a tree. And by this measure, Cramer's risk-adjusted return is exactly what you'd expect. He is, they conclude, neither extraordinarily good nor unusually bad. He is harmless.
I don't know how he'd think about being interpreted as being a harmless guy, but in the end, that's probably one way to interpret the study that we've got.
What does the literature say to you, and what is your conclusion after all these years about whether or not people can pick stocks and beat the market consistently?
You can't do it.
It's just an awfully tough thing to do when you're competing against people with very similar information and with very similar incentives.
We called Jim Cramer, and he declined to be interviewed. But then, just this week, he mentioned the study on his show.
Studies done by two professors at Northeastern, Paul Bolster and Emery Trahan. I don't know them. It shows, among other things, that my performance between July 25th of 2005, right after the show started, to December 31st of 2007 was, well, excellent.
Cramer talked about how the study said he'd beat the market, but he didn't mention the extra risk or that his performance wasn't really so surprising.
So, David, one of the questions we got a lot from listeners after that story ran is a pretty obvious one. This was analyzing Jim Cramer when the stock market was going up. It seems like, okay, so he picked some stocks during a big upswing that did better than average. But what about during the crash? How did he do then?
Right. So I asked them and they said, well, you know, we're working on that. We basically just analyzed the first 2.5 or whatever it is years of data. But I mean, the question is really not whether he's able to make money in the crash, right? It's whether he loses less money than the stock market lost in the crash. You know, did he beat the index, right? So there are some websites which try to track his picks. They do it differently than the way these guys did, but it looks like going by that, he did do better again than the stock market indexes.
Right, but this is where the efficient market hypothesis comes in and helps us. And what it helps us is to say, and I want to say this, David, you're not recommending that all Planet Money listeners just go out and watch Cramer's show and do whatever he says, right?
No, we're not.
Because the thing is, even if you were able to figure out on a day-to-day basis where the stock market was going and you're able to pick stocks right, every time you trade a stock, you pay something. You pay a fee to your broker. Even if you have one of these super cheap online services, you're still paying, say, $8 every time you trade. So if you're trading hundreds of times a year, your trading costs are in the thousands of dollars. And you have to actually not only beat the stock market, you have to beat the stock market plus all those transaction costs, all the costs of beating the stock market, which makes it all much more difficult.
Yeah, Bolster and Trahan make that point that if you take into account the transaction costs and you do what they're doing with buying all the stocks he recommends and selling, then really, in the end, you just end up getting the same returns as the average stock market. But it's worse than that because you've actually taken on more risk, which led me to ask them this question. Hey, how do you guys have your money invested? Are you stock pickers?
Silence. No, I've decided many years ago that I wasn't a stock picker. I thought that getting an advanced degree in finance and some other designations qualified me to be particularly clever in terms of selecting securities, but I found out very quickly that wasn't the case.
Emery?
Yeah, I would agree. I largely, that's where my pension is. Usually when you ask people that, there's a bias. They tend to tell you about the winners and not the losers, so you may get a biased result, but I actually had a couple of nice picks in the banking sector over the last 6 months, but that was probably more due to luck than any particular stock picking skill that I might have.
But so most of your money also is in like mutual fund, index funds?
Right, mostly mutual and mostly indexed mutual funds.
Yeah, that's so boring, you guys.
It is, but again, this is what if you look at the finance literature for years and years and years. Boring beats exciting most of the time.
So, David, the literature he's talking about, the book that I think is best for the lay people to explain this view is A Random Walk Down Wall Street by Malkiel. But it's basically the theory is the efficient market hypothesis. The strong version is that the market basically is always right, that whatever price the market has for the stock market, it contains all the information in the world, and it's exactly precisely right. But you don't have to go all the way there. I think a lot of people think, wait, that's nuts. That can't possibly be right. So the theory that most people who follow this at all follow is that maybe the price for any given stock is wrong, but for you personally to figure that out is almost impossible. And for you to consistently figure it out over the entire length of your investing life is really impossible. Because let's say you see something, I have a Kleenex box in front of me. So let's say, you know, I hear that Kleenex is opening a new factory and is coming out with some really cool new Kleenex tissue technology.
Or I noticed that like the number of colds are up or something. And,
yeah. Right. I think, oh, the swine flu's here. So people are going to start blowing their nose a lot more. Well, am I the only one in the world to know that? Probably not. And there's, you know, Wall Street and other places are filled with analysts studying this stuff every single day. So whatever information comes in is probably already represented in that price.
When I laid this out this weekend with my friend, he said, wait, this is crazy. He says, you know, why does anybody pick stocks then? And the other argument you get is, what about, you know, Warren Buffett? What about hedge funds? What about my cousin Joey? He does really well in the stock market.
There are a few examples, not many, of, one of the examples that people point out very often is Peter Lynch, who ran the Magellan Fund for Fidelity for a number of years and had an extraordinary record.
No, I did some research years back on Peter Lynch and found he's one of the great success stories in picking stocks. And I think he outperformed the market 9 out of 13 years when he ran the Magellan Fund. So, you know, even Peter Lynch didn't get it right every year, but on average over his tenure, he got very good returns relative to the market.
Now, is that skill, or is it just we have millions of managers out there, and there's definitely going to be one guy who just by chance does well 7 years out of 10 or whatever?
Well, yeah, if you had 100,000 monkeys throwing darts at the Wall Street Journal picking portfolios, you know, maybe one or two of those over the years would have pretty good results. So it could be due to chance. I don't think you can rule out that people like Peter Lynch have some skills, but it could be explained by chance.
I think this is the hard part about it if you're just kind of an ordinary person walking around trying to think about this, which is that, you know, we're not used to processing things statistically. You know, people all the time, you see this all the time in science, you know, people will say, well, I ate a banana and my headache went away. Therefore, you know, I bet bananas are really good at curing headaches. Like, you really have to do a long-term study, you know, to look at these things. Because if you get enough, you know, you always say you get enough monkeys together, one of them's going to type out the first words of Shakespeare. That doesn't mean that monkey is Shakespeare, right? It's just going to happen.
Right, it's just random. And the market is completely random. There's millions of people all over the world making billions of choices every single day. So there's so much data out there. You know, anyone can find any kind of pattern they want to see.
Right. And this idea of efficient markets, like, this is actually something that people have studied and they can measure. And Paul Bolster made this really interesting point, which is that you can sometimes see markets becoming more efficient, becoming more difficult to beat as there's more and better information available.
If you look, though, at other markets, say the market for fine art or the market for securities in an emerging market nation, you find that the level of efficiency is much less. In other words, there is the opportunity for somebody who's particularly insightful to make a lot of money. But as those markets develop and mature and as more people pile in, as more people see that there's the opportunity to make a lot of money, those profits go away pretty quickly as the market develops.
So we should make very clear, we are not making any recommendations on how to invest your money. That is not something we do at Planet Money, right, David?
Right.
You're not secretly trying to tell people what to do.
No.
No. I mentioned Burton Malkiel's A Random Walk Down Wall Street. I think that's a good place to start. I also like A Boglehead Guide to Investing. It's just a very basic introduction to this way of thinking. I will say that I personally, you know, when people ask me what stocks, you know, you're a business reporter, what should I invest in? I say what these guys say. I personally just invest in cheap, low-cost passive index funds. I stay as boring as possible. But David, I didn't read it, but you read this response to Malkiel's book called A Non-Random Walk Down Wall Street. That's by Andrew Lowe at MIT.
I have it on my shelf, and I read parts of it years ago. But yeah, he's basically making the case that people aren't rational, and sometimes they're not rational in a way that's consistent, in a way in theory you could make money at. So it's sort of a academic rebuttal.
And this is a battle. It sounds like if you want an inefficient market with high potential to make a lot of money, it sounds like North Korea.
North Korea, yeah.
You know, as a small and developing economy that doesn't have a mature, efficient system.
I just want to make one final comment here about Jim Cramer. And I have to confess that before the story, I'd really only seen him when I was at the gym on the TV. You know, there's no sound. And he does look like a crazy guy jumping around. But for this story, I sat down and I watched a full hour with sound. And if you put the stock picking craziness aside, like there are some Planet Money moments in there. Really?
Really? Like what we do, trying to explain the economy and
he didn't explain the efficient market stuff. But, there are moments there, like he explained different kinds of initial public offerings. He talked about the satellite industry, who the customers are, what the risks are. You know, I learned some stuff watching it.
Well, I'm going to give it another try, I guess. So basically, we are then saying go watch Jim Cramer and use that for all your investments.
I found it interesting.
Okay. Well, I think that's going to do it for us today. We have lots of goodies on the blog, don't we, David?
We do. There's a we got video of Kramer's rebuttal to the academic study of his stock picks.
We have the North Korea, the Google Earth plugin, the link to the blog. That's it. So three goodies.
All right. It's npr.org/money. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Adam Davidson. Thank you for listening.